from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. California Congressman Duncan Hunter pleaded guilty last week to illegally spending campaign funds. He says he'll leave Congress after the holidays. But there's a new development in this story. An ethics report has been released. On the phone is Morgan Cook, an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune's watchdog team. She wrote the original story on Duncan Hunter's campaign fund spending more than 2 years ago. She's followed his career from then through last week's guilty plea till now with a new turn in the story. Hi, Morgan. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this House ethics report. And the headline for your story today is that the report funds go well beyond the rabbit airfare and finds pervasive evidence of misspending. What's in this House ethics report?
This report is by the Office of Congressional Ethics, and that is the entity that recommends to the U.S. House Committee on Ethics whether there's, you know, needs to be investigation of certain matters that are the heart of complaints from the public. And so they produced this report. They did their own inquiry so that they could know whether they needed to send it over to the House Ethics Committee. And so they did that, and they recommended to the Ethics Committee that it do its own investigation. And the Ethics Committee was all set to do that until the Department of Justice came along and said, hey, can you please hold off on what you guys are doing so that we can do our thing? And the Ethics Committee said, okay. And that meant, though, that they didn't release the report from the Office of Congressional Ethics. And so they've kind of been holding on to it and keeping it confidential all this time while the Department of Justice has been doing its thing. And now that the Department of Justice is done doing its thing, then the report yesterday was released.
The report is available on the website, but the pages do say confidential at the top. I assume that confidential aspect then is a moot point.
I think as of now it is, yes.
So let's talk about the expenses in here. Compared to what you knew from your investigation, what does this report say?
The report says a lot of things that we found out as we were doing our own independent investigation. So it was really cool to read it and see, oh, they saw it as I saw it. You know, they saw the things that I saw. They identified the patterns that we did. And they had a lot more detail because they had, you know, they were able to get receipts. They were able to get the airlines to cooperate with them and give the materials. And they don't have subpoena power either, but they did get a lot more detailed information than we were able to get just straight up from the public records of FEC reports.
Because you said subpoena power, I want to shift back to the beginning on this because the prosecutor, Philip Halpern, said last week at the time of the guilty plea that it was your 384-word story that actually started this case. And you, in turn, said, without the power of the subpoena, we would be nowhere. So let's get into the reporting a little bit and explain what you meant.
Well, what I mean by that is that, you know, we are the watchdog. And if you think of us like a watchdog, you know, we're kind of limited of what we can do. Like, here we are protecting the junkyard behind the fence, and the fence is the subpoena power, right? So we can only go so far. We can only get the public records. We can only get to talk to people who want to talk to us. So when we see beyond the fence that there's a bush moving in a way that we know a bush should not be moving, our job is to bark at it until someone with subpoena power comes and has a look so that they can find out if it's a bunny or a burglar or what that is moving that bush.
I don't know.
But we can only go with the information we have is that that bush should not be moving like that. And so we just bark until someone comes.
Great analogy. I don't know if everyone caught the fact that you literally do call yourselves the watchdog team. So it works.
We do.
Well, in the picture you're painting. What launched that 384 story and what date was that first story published?
I think we published it April 4th or 5th. The reason that we wrote it is that my editor came across a letter. It's a public letter that the Federal Election Committee sent to Duncan Hunter's campaign. And that letter was a request for additional information, and it basically said, hey, Duncan Hunter's campaign, we see that you have spent a lot of money on video games and a payment to what appears to be a private school. And so we were wondering if you could please give us a little more information about what those, you know, the campaign or official purpose of those expenditures, because they look personal and personal use of campaign money is illegal. And so when we got that letter, when we found out about that letter, I went and got a hold of it and I read it and I consulted with some experts and I gave the campaign a call and I asked, you know, what's up with this?
You said that was in April. That was of 2017. Do you know?
2016.
2016. How many stories, how much of a reporting effort has been made on this one case since that time?
Wow, I actually don't know the number for sure, but I think it's 60 or more. A lot.
So Duncan Hunter's district is in the middle and northeastern parts of San Diego County, I believe, somewhat rural areas. And even though he'd been elected in this congressional role in 2012, serving since 2013, he wasn't new to politics. So what was the general take on him as a Republican politician?
Well, I think that people really were excited about him. They thought that he had a lot of potential. He had he volunteered for the Marines, and he did tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he served his country honorably, and he is the son of a lawmaker who is very respected in that district, very admired. And so I think people were really excited about him and thought that he was going to have a whole lot to offer.
Do you remember the initial reactions then to the story about the personal expense, the video game expense, your first story or couple of stories?
I do. We were calling some of the donors to his campaign to sort of ask them what they thought. And the response that we got was, you know, overwhelmingly, okay, well, something went wrong, but, you know, Duncan Hunter is a responsible, good person, and he's going to, you know, if mistakes were made, he's going to do what it takes to make it right, and we still trust him, and we know that this will be okay.
So I'm looking now, Morgan, at pages 2 and 3 of this ethics report that was just made public. And the list of categories for the use of campaign funds in personal instances covers a family trip to Italy, family trips to Hawaii, family trips to Arizona and Boise. It covers water bill payments, cable and utility expenses at home, a garage door replacement, dental care. It goes on to goods and services, including grocery and meal purchases. It goes on and on. At what point did you see this mountain growing bigger and hit a tipping point where that public perception and statement to you was really being overshadowed by what you were uncovering?
I mean, we reached that point relatively quickly. I think we got to it when he started paying his campaign back. And we were looking and saying, oh, we didn't realize that this was something that would need to be paid back. And then, you know, it kept getting bigger and bigger, and we kept seeing more and more things that you hardly ever see in campaign finance reports, like a garage door and a payment to an oral and facial surgeon, and just strange patterns that you rarely see at, like, fast food restaurants, gas stations, grocery stores. And we just sort of started to look at it all pile up and think to ourselves, wow, we need to ask some questions here because this is very unusual.
So Ricky Young, who is the head of your UT watchdog team, is quoted in an article I read saying the central difficulty in reporting the story has been with Hunter's team. Would you agree that that's the case and expand on the hurdles or the roadblocks that came up?
Sure. I mean, at some point, they weren't as willing to answer questions that we had, and they felt, you know, like maybe it wasn't fair that we were paying so much attention to them, and they didn't really want to participate. And that made things hard because, you know, I know that they had a side of the story, and I really wanted them to tell it so that, you know, we could understand. We just wanted to know what was going on. And of course I understand their position, and of course I understand their frustration, and I get that, but it made things pretty hard, you know, because you know, it's like they're saying there's nothing to see here, we're doing what we can to fix it and make it right, and at the same time, the documents are telling a different story.
I'm talking with Morgan Cook. She is an award-winning investigative reporter with the San Diego Union-Tribune's investigative unit. It's called the Watchdog Team. She started the series of reports on Duncan Hunter's illegal spending of campaign funds. Morgan, we're going to listen to Duncan Hunter in one of his public denials. This one was on Fox News in 2018.
I'm not going to resign with a bunch of leftist government folks throwing allegations at me. There's a trial. This means nothing. And the indictment is all they have. They only have what you've now seen. That's it. I've done nothing wrong.
So, Morgan, did your team's approach to reporting this change as he continued to deny that he'd done anything wrong? Did you get more assertive or aggressive in some way?
No, we just continued going where the facts led us, and we just kept our heads down and kept doing our jobs because that's what we do.
So then came this last week. We're going to listen now to his statement after the guilty plea.
I failed to monitor and account for my campaign spending. I made mistakes, and that's what today was all about. So that being said, I'll have more statements in the future about the future. Thank you.
How was that moment for you, Morgan?
I was a little surprised because inside he had just pleaded guilty to, you know, willfully, knowingly conspiring to illegally spend campaign finance money. And so I expected him to say something like that. And so, you know, I was kind of confused by it. And I wondered if perhaps he, I don't know. I was surprised by it.
How have you reconciled the continual denials of anything illegal and then finally the guilty plea?
I think that we've seen often in history that many times before people plead guilty, they deny wrongdoing. And I don't know if that's because they are just, you know, hoping that they will be, found not guilty, or if it takes a while to really come to terms, you know, on your own about what you've done and what it means. And, you know, if it just takes a while to reach that place where you can take responsibility for what you have done. But we do know that people tend to deny it, you know, forcefully until they don't.
So what do you think the rest of the story is going to be? Will there be prison time for him? And is any possibility of a career in politics now finally over?
I think that it will be interesting to see what the future holds. Right now, the prosecutors, as part of the plea deal that Hunter has made with them, they are going to recommend somewhere between 8 and 14 months of prison, I believe. But he could get up to 5 years. And I know that judges often feel most comfortable giving a lighter sentence when they feel like somebody has shown remorse and taken responsibility for what they have done. You know, so we'll see.
Well, the work has been so powerful, Morgan, especially in this time of repeated challenges against the press and against the concept of media. I am happy to post a number of links on our website for people to continue to follow the story. And I thank you so much for joining us. I hope we have a chance to talk again in the future.
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again, Morgan. And that is Morgan Cook, the investigative reporter whose story in 2016 on Duncan Hunter's campaign spending eventually led to his guilty plea last week and his impending resignation from Congress. You're listening to Insight. on CAP Radio.
This is CAP Radio, 90.9 Sacramento and 91.3 Stockton Modesto, your NPR station. We got support from River City Bank, supporting renewable energy companies with a clean energy division, offering tailored solutions to help make California a greener place to live and work. RiverCityBank.com, member FDIC.
Insight continues in just a moment right here on listener-supported CAP Radio, and we are hoping to end this fund drive this evening with your help. It's crucial to jump on board right now with an online contribution or by calling us up and supporting everything that you get from CAP Radio and NPR News here in the Sacramento Valley and Western Nevada. Hi there. My name is Nick Bruner. I'm joined with Sally Schilling.
Here we are. It's the last day of the fund drive, the last day of 2019 that we're going to be on air asking you to step up. Do you think CAP Radio is worth supporting? We're hoping your answer is an emphatic yes. And if that is indeed the case, then there's only one thing left for you to do. Call in with your contribution or donate online. But do it right now, because the drive is almost over.
And you're joining a big club of listeners and contributors when you make that contribution right now. By phone, it's 1-800-800-5867. Again, that's 1-800-800-5867. You can also contribute very, very, very fast at our website, capradio.org. And that club, you know, it's kind of like when, like, a dog sees another dog, they get really excited. It's kind of like this feeling like you see somebody with an NPR t-shirt and you go, me too. Make your contribution right now and support this radio station on a fundamental level. All the work that goes into it for another year of CAP Radio starts with your donation right now. Again, that's 1-800-800-5867, 1-800-800-5867, or at capradio.org.
And we know this is the giving time of year. Food banks throughout our region are in constant need of financial support. The good news is that during this fund drive, you can help your local food bank and Capital Public Radio at the same time. Just choose the food bank option instead of requesting a thank you gift. And we'll make sure a portion of your contribution goes to a food bank in your area.
That's right, public radio listeners. I mean, you are the type to step up in times of need when your community needs it and do exactly what Sally mentioned. Your contribution can go twice as far. You can help support CAP Radio and a food bank in your region. And when you support CAP Radio, you're doing exactly that. When you contribute to this radio station, you're supporting local reporters, you're supporting people curating great music on the regular between classical and jazz and modern music discovery. That's all here. It's online, it's on air, and it's because of you. Your donation supports it all. Right now, when you call 1-800-800-5867, 1-800-800-5867. Help us end this fund drive tonight by phone or capradio.org.
If you have that phone number memorized because you've heard it so many times.
It's tattooed on the insides of my eyelids, Sally. How about yours?
You have no excuse for not calling in. We know that you're listening to us. You're tuning in for the hearings, the impeachment hearings, but also, you know, state politics, like you just heard in the segment on Insight, you know, holding state officials accountable. If you value that, let us know and go to capradio.org. It's super easy and you'll feel good during this giving season that you've contributed to the radio station that you rely on. CAP Radio first began broadcasting April 2nd, 1979. That's 40 years of public radio in Sacramento. And what hasn't changed in all of that time is how you can rely on us to give you the news and information that you need. So call 1-800-800-5867 or go to capradio.org.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Women's right to vote under the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified in August of 1920, so next year is the centennial anniversary. California, though, ratified the amendment on November 1st, 1919, so the 100th anniversary is already being celebrated. The State Archives just released a digital exhibit titled On the Road to Ratification, California and the Struggle for Women's Suffrage. It's a terrific exhibit, and we posted a link to it. It features news articles, pictures, campaign literature. It's really great for any kind of a school report at any level. And it isn't just about California. The piece traces the long fight across the country for women's right to vote. In the studio with me is Professor Teresa Bergman, chair of the Communication Department at University of the Pacific in Stockton. She has researched and written a book titled The Commemoration of Women in the United States, Remembering Women in Public Space. Hi, it's good to have you back with us, Professor.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
There's a parallel here between that right to vote journey and the commemoration of women. Would you make the link?
In 1920, women finally got the right to vote nationally. And that's a long time not to be able to vote in the United States. So following that, and women being officially able to enter the public sphere, it took quite a while to begin to recognize women's contributions and lots of commemoration, particularly memorials on the National Mall and at the federal level. These large sites have been to politicians and to war heroes. And for women to start to be able to take these kinds of public roles and to receive that kind of recognition, it took a while to move along and for commemoration on a federal level with federal funding to be able to get into full swing.
You spent a lot of time in archives and, in fact, national parks yourself working on this. Why national parks and what were you searching for?
Well, this is one of the main places where we have a lot of commemoration takes place is in national parks and the National Park Service. And what I was particularly interested in researching this book and pulling this book together was how we as a country were remembering and commemorating women's contributions to the country itself as patriots and what our contributions were. Because previously, much of women's work had been behind the scenes, not in the public sphere, in organizing movements, in temperance, in abolition. And this level of organizing really wasn't recognized the way the leaders were, the way the elected officials were. So that when you go to a public space, a lot of these spaces are administered by the National Park Service that is very involved in commemoration and putting together sites where U.S. history is communicated.
By commemoration, for the most part, we're talking about statues, public statues, or something touchable in a public place.
Right, something you can walk into, something you can go visit on the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial, the Vietnam Women's Memorial, the Women in Military Service in Arlington National Cemetery.
Let me use, to give an example of what you were just talking about, the statue of Eleanor Roosevelt. And your chapter is titled Eleanor Roosevelt as Coda. And the point you make is that her service contributions were prolific and comprised a variety of progressive causes, and yet her likeness is safely, and here in quotes, relegated to a position in FDR's shadow. So the kind of diminutive nature that her role was treated is something that you want us to pay attention to and you think needs dramatic changing in terms of history.
And that was a really interesting chapter, and I wasn't even going to add to do any research and have a chapter on Eleanor Roosevelt's statue until I was researching with the on the history of how much commemoration to women there was in the National Corridor, and it turned out that there was only 6% of all of the statues, all of the memorials in D.C. were to women, and that included Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm. So I thought that would be an interesting place to start, and how did that come about? Because the FDR Commission put together to commemorate FDR started in 1955, and they didn't even start working on the memorial until the 1990s. And the first mention of Eleanor being added to that memorial was 1990. And
wow.
She wasn't even part of any of the plans, any of the iterations through all of the years. And finally, when Bruce Halprin was chosen as the architect, the landscape architect, he brought her and considered and suggested that she should be included in the memorial as well.
I'm going to jump to another commemorative statue, and this is the Vietnam Women's Memorial in the National Mall. And so let's just talk about women's patriotism and how that is being honored or commemorated.
One of the really interesting things about the Vietnam Women's Memorial and the Women in Military Service for America Memorial that's right across the way in Arlington Cemetery is these were ways we were commemorating women in the military. And these are military memorials. And both of them, I see them as sort of bookends for a way that we're looking at and the way we're thinking about and recognizing women's contributions to the military. Because until 2015, women couldn't serve in combat. And not being able to serve in combat really limited women's ability to move up through the military rank and enjoy all the benefits men have from military service. So what we have with the Vietnam Vets, the Vietnam Women's Memorial, is sort of an end of an era because it's nurses. It's three nurses, and they're metaphorical women. They aren't actual women. Mm. And then what we have in across the way at the Arlington is actual women who, and the entire history of women's work and contributions, paid and unpaid, through the military all the way through active combat. So it's they're very different experiences, very different representations, very different messages about what it means to be a woman who is part of the military.
You're listening to Professor Teresa Bergman from University of the Pacific. We're talking about her book titled The Commemoration of Women in the United States. It's an academic book, but it's also available to the public. And in fact, she's been busy with speaking engagements. Do women need new forms of commemoration now because of being absent in history? And what would that look like in your vision or imagination?
That's a really good question, and it's one that I certainly grappled with a lot when writing and looking at all of these places together. And in many ways, yes, we do need new forms of commemoration. And it's for women, it's for people of color, it's for all the groups that have been traditionally left out of commemoration. And that's one of the things that I saw. If there was anything that connected these sites that I looked at, it was that when you're trying to commemorate people who have been legally as well as socially kept from the public sphere, the way you start to recognize their contributions has to also be different because what they have been able to contribute in terms of their communities, their cities, the regions, the nation has been a different kind of contribution. So we need to think about ways to commemorate looking at that level of contribution to our nation.
In the conclusion, you write, during the writing of this book, the controversy surrounding the removal of Confederate statues and monuments erupted. And you go on to say, this controversy highlights the changing ideas of appropriate behavior and its place in commemoration. So there's a parallel there in the conversation you're having about women. But who else is writing or focusing attention right now, Professor, on the commemoration of women? There's a lot being done around the Confederate controversy, but as it pertains specifically to women?
Well, that's another really interesting point, because I think one of the things we need to think about once we start bringing in less underrepresented groups, we have all kinds of intersections. And it's women of color, and it's women from lower income groups and from different parts of the country, as well as men in similar positions. And the ways we have all kinds of really interesting new directions coming up in commemoration that's looking at all these intersections across the country. And that is very encouraging.
At the timing of this 100th anniversary approaching. So again, I go back to where this conversation might go, and what do you see in the crossover between the anniversary of the amendment, the right to vote, the commemoration of women, and the awareness that we're all coming to in how we honor people?
I think the main thing that we're coming to see is that women are involved in everything. and it's not just women's issues. I went to Montgomery recently to look at the Peace and Justice Memorial, also known as the Lynching Memorial. Women are very involved in every aspect of that memorial and who were lynched as well. I recently went to the coal mines in eastern Pennsylvania, the anthracite coal region, and women were very involved in all kinds of support levels for their husbands and sons that worked, and the kind of commemoration that's happening for their work in the community and keeping their families healthy and able to participate. And so what I'm seeing across the country, the Tenement Museum in New York, is the role of women is thoroughly included now, as opposed to let's just look at the men's participation. We see emphasis on both across the board as we look at not just necessarily the celebratory moments in our history, but also the parts of our history that got us to where we are today that might not necessarily be our most glowing moments, but they are part of our history, and women were present in every single instance.
Because we're in Northern California, I need to mention the commemoration in Richmond, California. And would you say something briefly about it? Because it's an easy field trip for a lot of people in this region.
Oh, yeah. It's a great site. The Rosie the Riveter Memorial, and in Richmond, California, that opened in 2000, dedicated in 2000, and it's just an amazing site. And the National Park Service expanded it, bought three more of the Kaiser shipyards, and have made this. There's a walking tour and an auto tour that's become that looks at the homefront industries during World War II and the Rosies that participated, as well as all the people, the working class people that participated in the home front work during World War II, and it's just an amazing site. They've done a great job.
I don't know what got you started on this. What was your aha moment?
I think my aha moment was realizing that democracy is not carved in stone, that the ways that we learn about what our history is, what's important, has to change. Because we change, and because the way that we commemorate, the way that we go to these sites, when I went to the Lincoln Memorial, when I went to Mount Rushmore, changes. And it's so important, if not vital, to embrace that change and to change our commemoration to represent who we are. Because when we were founded, we couldn't vote. Blacks were three-fifths of a person, and it takes so much effort to really be an active and vibrant democracy and really represent everything about what it means to have one person, one vote in every aspect, and every aspect includes commemoration. And I think that combination of being a historical tourist set me off, and it's like, no, I want to hear these other stories too.
One last question. What's the ongoing challenge in adding women to the landscape of commemoration?
I think one of the things is to remember that there's no one kind of woman, that we're just like everybody else. It depends on everything about us, intersectional in terms of our race, our religion, our location, our age, our history. Everything matters, so that all of that needs to be brought in when you bring women. So it's just not add woman and stir. That is actually a very thoughtful, and it looks at particularly the place that they came out of and what enabled their participation, because everyone's participation comes about for a whole different set of reasons.
Thank you so much. As I said, I think it's an ideal topic for a student exploration, for anything new. Thanks for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
That is Professor Teresa Bergman, professor and chair of the Department of Communication at University of the Pacific. We posted a link with more about her book, also a link to the State Archives digital exhibit. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.
This is CAP Radio 90.9 Sacramento, streaming at capradio.org. We got support from All Foreign and Domestic Body Shop in Stockton for more than 30 years. Authorized collision specialists for 14 manufacturers such as Tesla, Mercedes-Benz, and Jaguar. Collision repair for all makes and models. AFDBodyShop.com.
Thanks so much for listening to Insight today on CAP Radio here on the final day of our on-air fundraiser for 2019. We're asking you to get involved right now with a contribution to this radio station by calling us up or making it online at capradio.org. My name is Nick Bruner. I'm here to help you pay for another year of Insight along with Sally Schilling. Sally is our podcast director. We're asking you to become members of CAP Radio right now.
CAP Radio is your constant radio companion, your source of some of the greatest music ever composed, an important advocate for classical music in our community, and so many other things.
There are hundreds of organizations around the world that cover international news, right? So what keeps you coming back to CAP Radio? What keeps you coming back to NPR? Maybe it's comprehensive reports. Maybe it's Insight's way of connecting you with community events and what's going on here locally in the Central Valley and through Western Nevada. We are dedicated to, as thoroughly as possible, reporting right here at CAP Radio. And your financial support is the bottom line. Your financial support, your membership right now is what makes it all possible well into and beyond 2020. So I'm asking you right now to make a contribution of support. Consider $13 a month right now and call 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867. Or make your $13 monthly contribution at our website, capradio.org.
This is the last day to really stretch your generosity even further with that food bank option with your donation to CAP Radio. That's a portion of your gift that will be given to a food bank in the area. It's determined by your zip code, so you're going to be helping your neighborhood food bank along with CAP Radio. The more you give, the more meals we can help provide when you donate now at capradio.org or pick up the phone, 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867.
Join Austin from Auburn, David in Sacramento, Nicole in Sacramento as well, who writes, thank you for all you do. Sandra in Pleasanton, who enjoys the classical music that we have on our classical service. All of these are individual contributions that have been coming in to help keep us on track to end this drive today. And whether it's holiday shopping or donations to nonprofits, maybe you find yourself giving an awful lot right now. I just want to say thank you so much for every contribution that comes into CAP Radio. Thank you for considering us. Right now, make your donation and cross CAP Radio off your gift list. I promise, we've been good. We've earned it. Been doing it all year. Call us up at 1-800-800-5867 or donate at capradio.org.
You might think, oh, I don't know how much of a difference this is going to make if I, you know, start my monthly contribution of $10, $13. It's a huge source for us that really does keep this station going. We really depend on your contribution. And it's listeners like you that have helped launch CAP Radio and kept it going for 40 years. And when you donate, you'll get a new CAP Radio sticker as a thank you, and you'll qualify for all these other really cool welcome gifts. So donate now. You know it. 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org. Thank you so much.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In yesterday's show, we listened to Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn's jazz interpretation of the music scored for the Nutcracker Ballet by Tchaikovsky. Today, we're talking about Amy Seiwert's interpretation of the classic Nutcracker Ballet. She is artistic director of the Sacramento Ballet, and the show featuring her original choreography debuted last year. This year, it opens Friday, December 12th at the Memorial Auditorium and continues through December 22nd. Amy's back in the studio with us. Hello.
Hi, Beth. How are you?
Happy Nutcracker season to you.
Happy Nutcracker to you.
With Amy in our studio is Isabella Velasquez, who has the role of Marie. And Marie is an updated version, I hope I can say that with all respect, updated version of Clara. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, glad to be here.
Do you think it's appropriate to say it that way,
updated? Oh, for sure, yeah.
Okay. So, Amy, how widely are classic ballets like the Nutcracker open to someone else's interpretation?
Well, the Nutcracker, especially in the United States, every major city has their own interpretation of the Nutcracker that happens. So I think as choreographers, when we go to create this, we have to find our own point of view. Otherwise, there's no reason to add your name to the canon.
But you also have to be respectful of the audience's expectations. There are things that they will want in place.
Absolutely.
And in Sacramento, you came in on the heels of 3 decades of Ron Cunningham, Corinne Binda Cunningham, and that tradition of the Nutcracker. So what did you use for your own kind of guidance or criteria?
Well, and also with Ron and Corinne's version, I danced that version for 8 years. So it was very much in my body and in my psyche. And that version, as well as the one I grew up with in Cincinnati, which was by a gentleman, Freddie Franklin, those two were very much in my heart. But it was also so important to me, again, to find my own point of view with it so I wasn't plagiarizing this work that I had grown up with. I think it was important for me to keep things in very much in the classical language, not make it contemporary in terms of movement style or aesthetic, but to make it contemporary in terms of how do you say it? In terms of our societal mind today.
Your kind of pausing there makes me think, was this a feel more than something you could articulate as you're choreographing?
So in seeing so many Nutcrackers in so many years, I've probably watched at least 50
at
this
point. More than a parent, a child in the show.
So I've seen a lot of different interpretations of this work. And in doing so, oftentimes when I watch a ballet, I think, what would I change? What would I do differently? Mm. And a lot of those things had to do with contemporary sensibilities. It was very important for me to have Marie be a human, be a real person, not be an archetype of a perfect little girl. Things like that.
Well, that is a wonderful segue into talking to Isabella about Marie. Let me go back, though, and find out when you first saw the Nutcracker. Do you remember it as
a
little girl?
Yes, I think I saw the Nutcracker when I was like 6 or 7, and that's actually why I started dancing. So it was definitely a really magical experience.
How do you see the difference in what Clara was in that traditional version and who you were asked to be as Marie?
Well, I think the traditional version, like Amy was saying, is kind of like a fairy tale. Ours is still like has fantasy involved, but Marie here is like more relatable and realistic, I think.
What guidance did Amy give you in knowing what Marie's personality was or what her character would be?
She's very specific with like musicality and stuff and how we would do certain like miming scenes. But like inner character, we kind of were given the freedom to discover on our own, and then she would give us guidance from there. So it was very natural, like the character that I tried to be on stage. And I think it's a little different for each of the Maries playing the same character. So,
who is your Marie then? She's 15 years old.
Yes. She's 15. Everything's like exciting and still new for her. She still like messes around with her brother, but she's excited about getting to dance with adults now. She gets really scared at one point, but has to pick herself up by herself. She doesn't have anybody there. So she really goes through the story, and it's kind of like her coming-of-age story, I would say.
In your version, Amy, Marie and the Nutcracker Prince go through the Pine Forest.
Yes.
And they go to the Kingdom of Sweets. And what is the way that your Marie is challenged?
So there were a couple things so important to me to put out there. One is that... So the Nutcracker is a triumph of the imagination, really. So, you know, Marie's at the party with her godfather, she meets his handsome nephew, and, you know, she's involved again. She's coming of age. She gets to, we always say it's the dance she does with the parents is like when you finally move up from the kids' table to the adults' table. Mm-hmm. So that's all happened. And then she falls asleep and she has, of course, this fantastic dream. And in that dream, it becomes a nightmare. At a point, she's attacked by all these mice. And in this version of the story, at this climactic moment of the music where oftentimes someone will come out and rescue her, no one does. She falls to the floor and she cries. And it was so important to me to show, especially in a ballet that a lot of children are seeing, that she cries for a little while, then she dries her tears, and she picks herself up, and she walks through to the next part of the story by herself. I think it's important to show people that you can do hard things and that she had the inner strength to do that. And that's something we discuss, like the crying scene is something that we spend so much time discussing because it's important that it's real and not melodramatic and not too much and not too little.
Maria, will you add to that?
Yeah, for that scene particularly, it's just trying to be as realistic as possible, of course. So when I'm portraying crying, it's once the best thing about the whole act one is you start from the beginning and it's like the way that it flows. Once you get to that point, you're really engulfed in the character. So it just becomes much easier. And yeah.
That is Isabella Velasquez, who dances the role of Marie, an updated version of Clara, in The Nutcracker, performed by the Sacramento Ballet. Artistic director and choreographer Amy Seiwert is here. The ballet is December 12th through the 22nd. I want you to hear a little bit of Tchaikovsky's classic Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, and then I'm going to play some of that jazz version from yesterday that we heard. So here's how the music will sound in most of the Nutcrackers across the country. So recognizable. Yes. And who are your sugar plum fairies this year?
So we have four ladies who will be dancing Sugar Plum and four ladies who are dancing Marie. So Sugar Plum, Lauren Winterholder, Ava Chatterson, Kaori Higashiyama, and Julia Feldman. Sorry, Julia.
You got
blanking
it
there for a second. What I love about this company is all these artists are so strong and they are all individual. And what they each of them brings to the table are unique interpretations. So even though you're going to see the same choreography every night, you're going to see how they develop those characters differently. And I love that these dancers, I love to give them that freedom and I love that they take it.
So on that word interpretation, yes, let's listen to the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn.
Sugar rum cherry.
There's a little crinkle of your brow.
Yeah, no, I love it.
The pacing it would be pretty slow for ballet. Could you ever imagine doing some sort of jazz interpretation with the Nutcracker?
Well, I've actually danced a sugar rum cherry.
You
with,
have?
With Smeumann Ballet. That was one of the things that Michael did. And I don't know. My husband is a jazz trumpet player, so I'm very studied in the Ellington Strayhorn version of the Nutcracker.
Have you heard that music before, Isabella?
Actually, no, I haven't.
Yeah. It's really beautiful,
it's
and
really
there are
fun,
nine
though.
Tracks, but it's very different
yes.
from the classics that you're going into. Okay, there are pre-curtain talks. There's a special Nutcracker experience. There is an audio-described performance.
Yes.
There are a lot of details that we will put on our website, but let's get to the children. How many in this year's show?
Well, last night we had a rehearsal that involved 274 of them.
Wow!
Which was wonderful. And exhausting and wonderful. I mean, you know, most professional dancers, the Nutcracker is the first thing they do. So I did my first one when I was 8. We have children as young as 6.
Wow.
And they are amazing. And also the way our professional dancers work with those children is fantastic to see.
Well, congratulations. Good luck.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful opening night and a run. Thank you so much for talking more Nutcracker with us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Good luck, Isabella Velasquez and Amy Seiwert. There's much more about the Nutcracker on our website, which is capradio.org/insight. And again, this year in Sacramento, a reminder that the show is at the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.
From Sacramento State, this is Capital Public Radio, 90.9 KXJZ FM and HD Sacramento, 91.3 KUOP FM and HD Stockton Modesto, 90.5 KKTO Tahoe City Reno, and 88.1 KQNC Quincy, streaming at capradio.org. We got support from the law firm of Rothschild, Wishick & Sands, LLP, representing individuals and businesses in government investigations and professional licensing proceedings since 1991. Information at rwslaw.com.
My name is Randall White, and I'm the afternoon news anchor at Cap Radio. My first foray into broadcasting was as an intern at a small CBS television affiliate. And one day I come into work, and the afternoon news anchor called in sick. So they said, "Randall, how about you?" And I thought, yeah. By the time I sit down with my scripts in front of me at the anchor desk, it all started to just become overwhelming. All of my muscles tensed up. I couldn't turn my neck to look at my co-anchor. Did you ever see that episode of The Brady Bunch where Cindy goes on a TV quiz show, and the second the camera comes on, boom, she freezes up?
I didn't answer a single question. I was a real dum-dum.
That was me. Unlike my first time hosting TV news, you won't freeze up making your first-time donation to Cap Radio this year. There are no cameras, no audience watching you. All you have to do is visit capradio.org right now to get started, and thanks.
Make your first-time contribution to Cap Radio on the last day of our fundraiser on air. Hi there, I'm Nick Bruner, in with Sally Schilling, encouraging you to call 1-800-800-5867, 1-800-800-5867, or like you just heard from Randall White, you don't have to freeze up when you go to capradio.org. Again, the amount of money that I wish I had to find the footage of Randall just staring terrified into a camera.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
We've come such a long way. We have you to thank for this long way that we've come. 40 years of broadcasting in the Central Valley in Western Nevada. Keep it going right now with your donation.
If you've already donated, thank you so, so much. It means so much to see your name on this list of contributors and hear what programming you're passionate about. If you haven't yet, you might be mulling it over. You know all the wonderful things that come with donating here. You know about the thank you gifts, the grand prize drawing, and that listener contributions are essential to keeping Cap Radio on the air. Now, as we enter this final stretch, it's your time. Do you want to help ensure that Cap Radio is here to stay? If the answer is yes, donate right now.
It's easy to do by phone. All you have to do is call 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867, or make your online contribution at capradio.org.
I listen to Cap Radio because I want to have a holistic view. I want both the local news, which they do well. I want it to be objective, which is done well. And I also like the fact that they give me international and world news. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you so much for making your contribution this drive. If your first impulse is to turn to NPR when an event breaks, maybe like the impeachment hearings that we got out of the way twice for during this last week of fundraising on the air, you know that we're here because of decades of support from people just like you. Don't wait any longer to make your contribution. Help us end this drive right now with your call to 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
It's the giving season, so you've probably been thinking about making a contribution to some organization to benefit your community. How about a 2-in-1? If you donate now, a portion of that will go to benefit a food bank in your area. Call now, donate online, select that food bank option, and a portion of your gift will go toward buying meals at a food bank determined by your zip code. So it'll be a neighborhood food bank you can feel good about contributing to, along with your station, Capital Public Radio, that you depend on for all kinds of programming that you love. Give now, Now is the time. CapRadio.org or call 1-800-800-5867. 1-800-800-5867.
We do it with your help, one donation at a time. Yours is right now. Call us up, 1-800-800-5867. Make a monthly donation to Cap Radio in an amount that makes sense to you by phone or at our website, CapRadio.org.